Hello, you're listening to Playback Daily on Tuesday, the 18th of February. I'm Louise Herity, and here's some of what's coming up.
I am glad that Cher didn't really, read an awful lot of this book herself, because I don't like her voice. Right?
For sure. So often people tell working class stories, but they've never lived in the working class world. So I find that hard, because I think we should be able to tell our own histories. And I think where our communities are full of talent and writers and filmmakers and photographers and everything.
It is absolutely amazing. It's something that I never thought would ever be possible, to be honest. Before I went through and found out about this gene treatment, I had given no thought to any sort of cure to my sight loss at all.
Ahead of Ireland Reads Day this Saturday, Claire Byrne was joined in studio by Waterford librarian Tracy McEnany for some top book recommendations.
So we're going to start off with this debut feel-good novel, and you tell us that library goers have been raving about Remarkably Bright Creatures by Shelby Van Pelt. Tell us about this one.
This was recommended by two separate customers. So, of course, when we get recommendations for customers, I usually take a picture on my phone or write it down. So my phone is full of pictures of books. It's a gorgeous book. This book will make you happy. It's a real feel-good book, as you said. Tova O'Sullivan, she works as a cleaner in the aquarium at night. Her husband has died. Her son vanished at sea over 30 years ago. He was only 18 at the time. If you have nobody else to talk to, who do you talk to? Only the walls, or in Tova's case, the sea creatures. And she talks to Marcellus, who is a giant Pacific octopus, right? They only have a lifespan of 1 to 5 years. But what she doesn't know is that Marcellus knows what happened to her son and is going to try and find her, find the truth. But Marcellus gets out of the tank. He gets out of the tank nightly, it seems. And he was going for Chinese in the bins, and he got tangled up in wires, and she is able to get him free. And this is where the bond starts. Now, if you read this, you do have to look at My Octopus Teacher on Netflix, because it's just a brilliant book. But when someone told me about an octopus and in a tank and a bond, I thought, no.
You have to buy into this
one,
right?
You have to buy into it. But it's actually very, very good.
Mm-hmm. And there's a movie on the way already, isn't there?
There's a movie on the way. They're in talks with Sally Fields to play Tova. And Olivia Newman is co-writing the screenplay with John Whittington. So it should be fantastic.
So this is one now that, to get in on the ground level of this, because we're going to hear loads about that book in time,
and
most likely.
And it's kind of hard to get. You don't see it around too much, you know, but it's well worth reading, lads. Yeah,
so Remarkably Bright Creatures by Shelby Van Pelt. And you heard it here first. You're going to hear more about that one. Next one up then is Time of the Child by Niall Williams. What's this one about?
This is, again, I must be going through a phase of feel-good books or just lovely books. It's 1962. It's in the village of Faha. It's around Christmas time, and the doctor, Jack Troy, and his eldest daughter, Ronnie, they opened their door one evening to be presented with an abandoned child that they found, that a young child found it at the village fete. So what is going to happen to the baby? This is 1962. It's different times. Mm-hmm. You know, if you find a baby on your doorstep, you're going to ring the authorities, and the baby's gone and never seen again. And the father and the daughter have been kind of unlucky in love. So they have an awful lot of love for this baby. Now, we've seen Faha before, because Niall Williams wrote another book called This Is Happiness. And This Is Happiness is set around 1958. So it's a companion piece to this book, he's calling it. And it is about the electricity coming to Ireland, and a bit of romance story. But that is actually a very, very good book too as well.
So maybe go to that first, would you say?
Oh,
This Is Happiness.
Come here. Niall Williams, I think all his books are just really fantastic. You have Four Letters of Love, and that's going to be the film of Niall's first novel. That's premiering at the Dublin International Film Festival on Wednesday the 26th in the Lighthouse Cinema. And the film festival runs from the 20th of February to the 2nd of March. But Four Letters of Love was published in 2014. I haven't read that. I certainly am going to read it. But I just loved, I love This Is Happiness. Okay. Anybody I give it
to. So This Is Happiness was published in 2019.
Yeah.
And the new one is Time of the Child, which is related to This Is Happiness.
Yeah.
But it sounds to me like you could probably read it
absolutely
independently.
Yeah.
But you're saying this is popular now with your customers.
Definitely.
In the library.
Yes, definitely.
Okay, so let's put that on the list as well. Christine Dwyer Hickey, Our London Lives.
Christine Dwyer Hickey, a lot of people would know her from Narrowlands, which was very popular last year. This is Our London Lives. It's about Millie, a teenage runaway, and a boxer called Philip or Pip. It spans 40 years. The book is told in alternating viewpoints. One chapter will be from Pip, the next is from Millie. The book looks back on Pip's life. So when you see Pip for the first time, it's 2017. He's a recovering alcoholic living with his brother, and that's where the story starts for him. But Millie's story is told then in the correct sequence, and she starts 1979. She's come over from London, I think come over from Ireland, County Louth, and trying to start a new life in London. Very good depicting the characters. It's so fabulous. It's like 512 pages.
I was going to say to you, it's a huge book, isn't it?
No, forget about it. 512 pages. Get on an audiobook if you want. You'll fly through this. It gives you like sort of the historical events too as well, happening in London at the time, 70s, 80s, Ireland, and, you know, Irish people living over in London. Mm-hmm. So that is really, if you were living in London at that time, this is the book for you. Okay, but book for anybody, really.
You get lost in this one, it sounds like.
Absolutely.
And you probably miss it when you're finished then.
Ah, yeah, no, I loved it. I love the characters. Oh, absolutely. They say it's a romance story, but it's a romance story, but not a traditional romance as we know it.
Okay,
anyway,
so there's more to that. Let's remind people of that title. It's Our London Lies by Christine Dwyer Hickey. We've another debut novel now. We love to see these coming. This is by Cork author Amy Jordan called The Dark Hours.
This is, I noticed it was number 6 in the bestsellers list last weekend. It's 2024. This was published in 2024. It's Julia Hart. She wants to disappear in a sleepy village of about 1,000 residents in a remote part of Ireland. It is set in 2024, this book. Her past comes back to her. Julia has a past she wants to forget. And in 1994, herself and her Garda partner, Adrian Clancy, are called out to a sleepy housing estate due to a noise complaint. Nothing's going to be happening here. Mm-hmm. But of course, when they arrive on the scene, a girl runs across from a house covered in blood and the sound of another girl in the house crying. Now, Julia runs in to save this girl. So who wouldn't really, you know what I mean? Saves the girl. But that is a big mistake and it just falls apart.
So that's what happened in 1994.
But now in 2024, the serial killer, they did catch that serial killer from 1994. I'm not going to say anything too much about it, right? But they do mention his name straight off. James Cox. He is the serial killer from 1994, which they caught. He is now dead. But similar crimes now start happening again in 2024. So it goes back to that. It's kind of like two stories. So it's actually very, very good. Like, I loved it.
And a creepy start to the book, which you found captivating.
Oh, really creepy start to the book. If your electricity goes off, and you've read this book, you would be frightened, I can tell you anyway. But it's very, very good. I hope we see an awful lot from Amy Jordan at Cork. She used to work in the civil service, but now full-time writer. You know,
good for her. Amy Jordan, The Dark Hours, which is her debut book. Doing well in the charts and doing well in the library as well, which we love to hear. That's one now that could make it on to film. Do you find that there's a big upsurge when something is coming out? Like we have Saoirse Ronan's The Outrun now. I'd say that's doing well, is it?
Absolutely.
I'm reading that myself. That's why I mentioned it.
Yeah, no. When someone mentions that the book is going to be in a film, it's great for the book. Do you know what I mean? So it's there. Everybody's looking for it again. Mm-hmm. Everybody rereads the book even. Do you know what I mean? Then all the book clubs are looking for it. Yeah. So it's just a knock-on effect.
And you have disappointed people who can't get hold of it then, of
course. Yeah. But we'll take care of you now. We find a way. Yeah, yeah.
You'll get it one
way or
the
other. Of course.
Now, if people like, people listening like celebrity memoirs, sure, the memoir part one might be the one for you. I saw her at the Saturday Night Live 50th anniversary with the fabulous hairstyle and she looks amazing.
Amazing.
Did you listen to this one?
I listened to this, but I am glad that Cher didn't really read an awful lot of this book herself because I don't like her voice. Right?
Poor Cher.
So I know it's funny because it was like it's Stephanie J. Block. She reads an awful lot of it. You get into the whole Sonny and Cher. Part one I thought was a bit of a cop out. You know this part one? Bill Gates is supposed to have a 3-parter autobiography coming up and I just thought, no, come on lads. Because you're going to have to pay 3 times to read the book,
that's
right?
That's the point. That's why they're doing it.
But in Cher's case, yes, I will be looking for part two and she is very, very clever. She packed it into this book. The celebrities, Warren Beatty, you know, the Stones, the Beatles, they're all in this. It's really, really good. I love it. It's mostly Sonny and Cher. It ends up the book really where she parts ways with Sonny. But Sonny and Cher actually had a Comedy Hour TV program. Did you know that?
Yeah, probably. Well, I kind of heard of it, I think.
But it's on YouTube still. I looked it up. It's gas, you know. But all I can now, once after reading Cher, all I can remember in my head is I've Got You, Babe. That's going round and round my head. Yeah. So, but I do like Cher, I must admit. But I just don't like her speaking voice.
Okay, but it was a good listen nonetheless.
Very, very good. Okay, and so part two is out in 2025.
Right, so Cher, the memoir, part one. And that might be something to listen to on Borrow Box, which is there for people, for members of the library. The younger readers now, you have some picture books for us.
Picture books are Wee Place by Sophie Kirtley and Ellen Rankin. This is Adventures of Grandad. If you're going to Northern Ireland, this is a perfect book for you. The Golden Hair by Paddy Donnelly. This is another Grandad adventure, a gorgeous illustrations, nature book, Adventures in Nature. It's actually lovely. And then for the Dublin people, I've picked this out, Stockingopolis by Tatiana Feeney. It's about a grey town that grey stockings, big socks, and Ben and Lucy set out to paint the sheep a bright colour because they want the wool to be nice and bright, of course. And on the last page, you have Stockingopolis is a real place and his actual name is Balbriggan, and the small seaside town in County Dublin, famous for its textile products.
Now, you better mention the big read, Ireland's big read.
Ireland up. Reads, yes, Ireland Reads Day. It's been really kind of Ireland Reads Month, February. And of course, we've been, you know, promoting Borrow Box. We want everybody to get lost in a book on Saturday the 22nd of February.
This Saturday,
absolutely. There's probably events going on in your local library. Check it out. Membership is free. No fines whatsoever. And as you said, Borrow Box. When we tell people about Borrow Box, you know, the free app for e-books, e-audiobooks, e-magazines, e-newspapers, they cannot believe it. They say, that sounds too good to be true. It isn't. It is true. But again, like I'm looking at some of the events. We got some of the events sent in. Donegal, right? 10 Books to Change Your Life by Kenneth Monaghan. That'll be fantastic. Leash Libraries, best-selling author Amanda Cassidy and Andrea Mara. They're going to be there for the afternoon. Very, very good. Then you've got Celia Hearn. She's in Dublin. Cork, you've got Leona Ford. Leona Ford, we love
our
Leona
friend
Ford.
Who was with us here in the show.
And then Eve MacDonald is in Wexford, and then in Waterford. Of course, we have something in Waterford. We're having a teddy bear story time, and we're doing bookmarks. But we're always doing something. Libraries, join your local library and get involved in Ireland Reads.
Well, listen, if people want to find out more, irelandreads.ie is the place to go.
And that was Waterford librarian Tracy McEnany with some top book recommendations ahead of Ireland Reads Day this Saturday on Today with Claire Byrne. Later on Liveline, Joe Duffy and his guest paid tribute to a remarkable Irish woman, neuroscientist Eleanor Maguire, who sadly passed away recently.
The New York Times on Saturday, which I happen to be reading, had an obituary for a young Irish woman called Eleanor Maguire. When I saw the name, obviously I had a view that it might be Irish, but Eleanor Maguire, it turns out, has died at the young age of 54. She was buried in early January. From Dublin, her parents, Anne and Paddy, still based in Dublin, predeceased by her brother Declan. But Eleanor Maguire, it now emerges, was a remarkable individual, a remarkable neuroscientist, a cognitive neuroscientist, and a remarkable character. And which prompted us to, because we did it about a month ago, 2 months ago, Irish women who for some reason, and Eleanor is only recently deceased, unfortunately, but for some reason have been forgotten. And it's taken the New York Times to shake me into, and other people into, realising who this and asking, who is this remarkable woman? And Professor Shane O'Mara is Professor of Experimental Brain Research Psychology in Trinity, and he's on WhatsApp at the moment. Good afternoon, Shane.
Hiya, Joe. How are things?
It's the wrong way to go at it, but why did the passing so young, 54 years of age, of this incredible neuroscientist, why did it virtually go unremarked, as far as I can see, in Ireland?
I don't have a good answer for you there, Joe, is the honest truth. It didn't go unremarked within the neuroscience community here or internationally. The news of it went around the world very, very quickly. And to be honest, there was great sadness and shock at her passing at such a young age. And she did feature in various obituaries. I know she was in The Guardian and various other places
The New York Times, that's right. Picked it up.
Yeah, she. I don't think it was especially noticed here in Ireland, apart from within the kind of relevant community, which I hope we'll get a chance to redress a little in the next few minutes.
And tell us about Eleanor Maguire.
Yeah, so Eleanor is from Rochestown Avenue in Dublin. She did psychology in UCD, and then this is back in the late 80s, early 90s. Then went to Swansea and did an MSc in neuropsychology, which is the study of people with brain damage.
Okay.
And then she came back and did a PhD under Teresa Burke, who was at UCD at the time. And they did a remarkable piece of work on people who had surgery to a particular part of the brain known as the hippocampal formation. Typically, this would happen after somebody might have epilepsy that doesn't respond to drug treatment. Wow. And what she found was that these people had grave difficulties in orienting themselves in space. So they didn't have a what you might call a cognitive map of the world. It was a beautiful piece of work for the time. She then subsequently won a fellowship from the Wellcome Trust and went to London and did amazing things funded by the Wellcome Trust over the next 30 years.
And tell us about this. You got to know her in the 90s. She would have been born she would have been born 1970. She was only 54 when she passed.
That's right.
And then this, which was really highlighted in the New York Times, this incredible study. Well, first of all, the idea of it, of studying London taxi drivers. And the brain, the hippocampus.
So she had a love-hate relationship, I think, with that study. She had a really interesting moment of insight watching a program about taxi drivers and training that they do over a long period of time. So reflecting back on the work she had done on her PhD, showing that the hippocampal formation was needed to learn about where you are in space, she thought, well, if this is true, maybe we can pick up a change in the brain related to people who have learned the 15 or 20,000 streets that there are in London. Yeah. So what she did was recruit taxi drivers.
Because taxi drivers in London, I remember seeing the black and white Pathé News. Yeah. The taxi drivers in London, I don't know if they still have to do a thing called the knowledge. Which is from their memory, they're asked, take me from Paddington Station to Holborn Station, the quickest route. And then they explain to the examiner what route they would take. And it's just a phenomenal amount. So Eleanor spotted this and said,
let's take these drivers who take 3 to 4 years to learn the routes and compare them with bus drivers who follow a fixed route.
Okay.
And what she found was an early example of what we now refer to as brain plasticity, that the rearmost part of the hippocampal formation was larger in the taxi drivers and was greater in volume related to the amount of time that you spent on the road. So the kind of claim that she was able to make reasonably strongly was that the brain was changing because of experience.
Wow.
And that experience affected not the brain as a whole, but a particular part of the brain that was concerned with doing a particular thing. In this case, organizing your spatial knowledge of the world, how you find your way around in the world.
And how did she go about? Did she wire up taxi drivers and wire up non-taxi drivers and try and spot the difference in terms of the activity in the brain?
So a bit more subtle than that, actually, okay, but not far off. Yeah. This was at the start of what's called the brain imaging revolution. So she was able to use MRI scans of the brain. And so she recruited taxi drivers, she recruited bus drivers, and she was able to make the comparisons between the bus drivers and the taxi drivers. And this difference was clear. It was obvious, and it was one that fell out on inspection from the MRI scans. So it's not an obvious thing to do, mm-hmm. but it actually answers lots of questions about how training affects the brain. Does it make a difference to what goes on in particular brain regions? How much training you need in order to have those effects come out? And it also explains a mystery, which is, why is it that people who suffer in particular from dementias that affect this part of the brain are lost in time and space? It's because this brain structure is key to understanding your orientation in time and space.
Which is an incredible revelation in the world we now live in.
Yeah, isn't absolutely. It? Yeah.
And that's brain plasticity.
Yes, absolutely.
Does that mean there's parts of the brain that you can take to the gym, basically, to the
That's a great analogy, actually. And the answer to that is yes. Use it or lose it, train it, and you'll continue to win with it.
And it also proves. I'm told she had a great sense of humour, because I watched her her funeral service over the weekend when I came across her name on RIP. And that came across. She loved stand-up comedians. Seemed to have a great sense of humour. But she did prove.
No, she was great.
She did prove that travel broadens the mind for certain London taxi drivers, at least.
Yeah, for sure. But you know, I think the ironic thing is she'll always be remembered for that taxi study, and correctly so. But the work she went on to do afterwards, I think, is really much more interesting in many ways and much more profound. And would you believe one of her students, Demis Hassabis, won the Nobel Prize a few years ago, not for his work on the things that she had been doing or he had been doing with her, but she had a very good eye for talent and for developing talent. And as you said, she was very witty. It was always a pleasure to have dinner with her or whatever. She was very, very amusing and full of life and joie de vivre, as it were.
And what you mentioned, that there's other stuff she should be remembered for apart from the
So she did something really interesting and not obvious, which I think helped us understand again lots of the things that go wrong in dementia. So she took a group of these patients that have damage to this part of the brain from a viral infection, so that they basically had destruction of it. And she asked an unusual question. She asked, instead of can they remember the past, she asked, can they think about the future? And what she found was that these amnesic patients can't imagine the future. That, in fact, what they do is they live in a perpetual present, and they can't imagine the world as it is now being different to the world as it is now. So they can't plan holidays next year. The details they'll give you about what they're thinking about in the future are very, very limited. And they're very kind of focused on what they can see and experience in the moment. It's not like their thoughts or their minds are empty of thought. It's just that their thoughts are driven not by abstractions about what I'm going to do next week or next year or whatever. They're very, very much driven about, well, I'm making a cup of tea at the moment, so I'm thinking about the switch that I have to press on the kettle. And, you know, it's a very kind of, as she put it in the paper, stimulus bound. And I think that opened up a phrase that we use commonly in the literature, which is mental time travel, which is the ability to flick forwards and backwards in your mind. I'm going to do this next year. I did that last year. I'm doing this at the moment. And that's denied this group of patients. And her work shows that it actually results from activity in this part of the brain, which is the same part of the brain that the taxi drivers have in large volume in.
Professor Shane O'Mara, Professor of Experimental Brain Research at Trinity College Dublin, talking about the late Irish neuroscientist Eleanor Maguire, who died in January. And you can listen back to the whole show on the RTE Radio app. On Today with Claire Byrne, we heard about a Sligo patient who has had his sight partially restored after 13 years of functional blindness. This is because of a groundbreaking new ocular therapy at the Mater Hospital. Here's Claire with the story.
Well, this gene therapy, which received approval for reimbursement in Ireland only last year, it has the potential to restore retinal function and vision in patients with retinal degeneration and vision loss, which was previously untreatable. And I'm joined now by Stuart Haxel from Sligo, who recently had this therapy, and also Professor David Keegan, retina specialist at the Mater University Hospital. And it's lovely to have you both with us. Thank you for being here. Stuart, I'm going to start with you because you have had this therapy. You've regained some of your sight. How incredible.
It is absolutely amazing. It's something that I never thought would ever be possible, to be honest. Before I went through and found out about this gene treatment, I had given no thought to any sort of cure to my sight loss at all. I had just wanted to find out what type of genetic condition I actually did have. So to find out that my genetic condition was compatible with this gene treatment, absolutely inconceivable that anything like this could happen.
Right, so you just wanted answers. But you ended up getting a treatment. So will you talk to us about your sight then and what happened over the years? So what was your sight like when you were a child?
I had a lot more sight when I was younger. I was able to use large print books and zoomed up magnification software. But over the years, it just got worse and worse until I started using speech software, which basically reads out everything for me on technology. And it had gotten so bad to the point where I could possibly maybe see a bit of light if the sun was very glary. But now after the treatment that I received last year, I was able to read large letters that Professor Keegan held up to me. I think it was about 2 weeks after the second treatment, he held up a large print letter and I was able to read it, and I think I came out of that room shook, to be honest.
Do you know what? I'm trying to imagine what it was like to be in that room when that happened. Yeah, I'm sure you could scarcely believe it.
Honestly, no, I don't think it had really hit me that I'd actually gone through with the treatment and that it actually had made an actual impact until that moment. Mm-hmm. It didn't really land.
And has it changed your life since then? Is it that much of a difference that it has changed things?
I feel it has. I haven't gotten all my sight back, but the bit that I do have back, it's absolutely amazing. I'm able to feel like I can come into a room and get a clearer idea of what to expect coming into a room. I can't see particular details, but if I'm close to maybe, say, a big, huge table, I might get an idea that the table is in front of me, mm-hmm. but I mightn't be able to tell what's on the table.
Right, but so you had a sense coming into this studio what the room was like today.
I had a better sense, yes, of the room than I would have before November last year, definitely.
Yeah, well, that's a great improvement. So, David, let's talk about the therapy and the treatment. But before we do, can we go back into that room when you showed the big letters to Stuart and he could see them? What was it like?
I was very glad to say that even doing this as long as I've been doing it, that you can still get surprised and remark with Stuart and his mum, you know, when there's a moment like that. Colleagues of mine have delivered this treatment all over the world over the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. We're sort of playing catch up to some extent, and they told me about those moments. But to actually have Stuart there and doing it, not really expecting, but going through the steps to see how far his vision had improved over those couple of weeks. And it was after Stuart's second eye treatment, and it was 2 weeks after that in the second eye that we treated. The first eye took a little bit longer to catch up. So I didn't really have that expectation that 2 weeks after that treatment that he'd be able to map out letters. And Stuart was able to. And there was one moment when we showed a different letter, which actually was a J, and Stuart couldn't say it to me. And I went, well, maybe it's not quite as good as we thought. But talking to a colleague of mine in London who does a lot of artificial retina work, we remember a patient like Stuart who haven't had that sort of sight for that long, they sort of forget what the letter. So
you hadn't
Stuart
seen a J for many years.
Oh, it had been so long. I could trace it out, but I couldn't really connect it in my brain to kind of match up the shape of what I was seeing. So it was...
So once you realised that, David, that it was possible he was seeing the jay but maybe couldn't identify it, you must have had a moment in that room where you thought, but this has worked. This is the result that we'd all hoped for.
It has worked. Well, the first thing you're doing that day is making sure no harm has come to Stuart's eye. Those first visits are that, because we've got to detach the retina to deliver this therapy.
Mm-hmm.
So while it's a fairly routine operation, 90% of it, we now have to inject this fluid that's got the virus, that's got the new gene in it underneath the retina. So we've got to detach it. So make sure we've done no harm first. That's the goal.
Yeah.
Once we've confirmed that, then the next piece is, has Stuart got any function back? And because he's had such poor function for a long time, that was a little uncertain. So it was great for Stuart and for his mum. There was a bit emotional, Stuart, in the room that day. And but then Stuart's got to get on with his rehabilitation, and then we've got to get on with minding Stuart's eye and make sure that's maintained. So just 2 weeks ago, then we were able to confirm in the objective measurements, you know, these very important tests for patients, that objectively, as well as what Stuart had seen subjectively, that there's been an improvement in how his retina works.
So what will happen now for Stuart? Will you see further improvements, or do you reach a level and you wouldn't expect it to improve beyond that?
We would hope there'd be some slight further improvement. I'd say most of the improvement has happened for Stuart already. And remember, Stuart is a little older than what we would like. Ideally, we would have got Stuart when he's 4 or 5 years of age. The ideal time to treat patients with the particular condition Stuart has, which is called RPE 65 associated Leber's congenital amaurosis, the full scientific title, that type of retinal degeneration, the younger, the better. We have had 3 children treated. Unfortunately, they had to go abroad because we hadn't had the approval. And while we were set up to do it, but that's, you know, they couldn't wait for the treatment. So it was done through a different mechanism. But now we could really nice to be able to say that it's approved in this country. We can treat patients in this country. We're all set to go at the matter to do it. The pharmacy team, the whole team is there ready to deliver that and follow on from the success that Stuart has had.
But is this quite a rare condition, or will there be many people who might be able to benefit from this in Ireland?
In Ireland, we estimate between 5 and 10 patients in the country will have this condition any one time. And maybe we'll detect another one patient every 2 or 3 years to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So on one hand, it seems like it's an awful lot of work to go through to treat a few patients. But we already know there's a full raft of treatments coming down the track for more common retinal degenerations. Things like X-linked retinitis pigmentosa, another condition of achromatopsia, and Stargardt's disease that are more common. So it's important that we have this ability, we have the technology, and we have the knowledge and wherewithal in the country to do that, which we do now.
Okay, so what was the procedure like, Stuart, for you? I understand that you had to lie there and pretty much not move for 24 hours.
Yes, but to be honest, the first I was a bit nervous, because even though I had met with David to kind of go over what exactly to expect, I was a bit nervous because I'd never gone into a surgery that I had remembered, to be honest. So it was my first pretty much surgery. I didn't know how it would work, or how I was afraid, oh, would the anaesthetic work, or like things that obviously
normal,
like 100%
fears
would work.
Yeah.
But it was difficult. The recovery was tricky enough because I had to lie flat and prone for 24 hours to allow the retina to reattach properly. And that was tricky, but I honestly, I'm so glad that everything went so well.
Mm-hmm. It was worth it.
It was worth it, even though it was difficult at points. It definitely was worth
mm-hmm.
it.
Just explain to us that procedure and how it works, David. In layman's terms, if you can.
What Stuart had was an operation called a vitrectomy, mm-hmm. where we removed the jelly inside the eye. That's behind our lens. And that then gives us access to Stuart's retina. And the drug itself comes in a very clear vial. And we have to inject that with a very small needle underneath the retina. And that's how we deliver it. We've got special equipment to track all that in the operating room at the time to make sure we're putting it in the right place.
Mm-hmm.
Once we've done that, then we're comfortable we have that. And then we put a little air bubble inside the eye The operation takes about 45 minutes. It doesn't take that long. And then Stuart has to recover on his back. That's why he had to lie very still for 24 hours.
No moving for 24 hours because you need that retina to reattach. Is that what's going on?
Reattach. And then the new gene is delivered in a virus, a safe virus called an adenovirus. And that's got to infect the cells where the new gene has to go. So in those 24 hours, that virus is infecting the cells, transferring that new genetic information out of the virus into Stuart cells to start making the correct enzyme. That's the fundamental problem.
It's
there. There's an enzyme we need that recycles this protein for us so we can see. Mm-hmm. There's a full recycling mechanism in there, and that's where the deficiency is. So it's just sort of rebooting the system with the new enzyme.
It's incredible. And how are you finding the other Stuarts in the country?
Well, that's tribute to the, we call it the Target 5000 program for rare inherited retinal diseases. So we set up a full program. This goes back to 2010 when we sort of really started this initiative to identify all patients in the country with inherited retinal degeneration. So Fighting Blindness underwrote that initially a research initiative, mm-hmm. But then we've grown it into a clinical program. So we've got a full clinical genetics team now that oversees this. Now we're putting a national registry together so we can better identify and mind and then manage patients. So like I said, we've about 200 patients now on that register who'd be suitable for late phase clinical trials, but also means even if you don't get them onto clinical trials, they'll be suitable when those new drugs become available. So now we've identified probably 85% of all the patients in the country with inherited retinal degenerations have been identified, and we're getting diagnoses to these patients. So addressing that initial thing that Stuart came in for was, what's wrong with me? Why do my eyes work this way? We're resolving that for many, many patients in the country.
So this is the start, really, isn't it?
This is the start. This is the start of the precision medicine era.
Mm-hmm. And in many ways, Stuart, it's a start for you as well, because I'd imagine your life has changed, has it, since you had this surgery?
It has. I'm constantly trying to figure out, what can I see now? Or I've family members asking, can you see that and see this? It's been fun trying to figure it out, what differences there are. And yeah, I'm looking forward to keep trying over 2025 to see how it develops.
Well, we wish you well. And it's an incredible story and so good to meet you. David, thanks as well to you for coming in and telling us about it. And I hope that so many more people now can benefit from this as we progress.
Stuart Haxwell and Professor David Keegan, retina specialist at the Mater Hospital, on Today with Claire Byrne. A public meeting in Ballinamore, County Leitrim, last night heard calls for a task force to be established to tackle power outages in rural areas following major storms. Some homes in South Leitrim were up to 3 weeks without power after Storm Yoan as trees fell across power lines. Now, the meeting was called to discuss what plans can be made on a local and national level in the case of another big storm in the future. And Northwest correspondent Shane O'Curraheen had this report on Morning Ireland Today.
People had been out 16 days, 19 days. Is there anything that we can do as a community before the next storm comes, which it will come?
Maureen Martin chaired this night's public meeting, organised by the Ballinamore Area Community Council.
We called tonight's meeting because a lot of people had concerns and had felt that they weren't listened to. And especially in the rural areas, like the Community Council covers 5 areas, Aughwillan, Auchnashiellan, Ballinamore, Corralaghan and Drumreilly. Corralaghan in particular was out for 20 days, I think.
People took the chance to share their experiences following Storm Eoghan.
We were out of power went into the third week. I had the 2 children in the bed with me, just to keep warm with hot water bottles. We moved into a caravan to try and stay warm during the day, but I'm grateful that we did have the caravan.
It was into the third week before I was reconnected. It was a frightening thing for me. You know, COVID didn't shake me, but this did. It really scared me, and it made me feel hopeless, actually. And I'm not a person like that, because I come from a farming background, and if plan A doesn't work, we go for plan B. But I just didn't feel able for it, you know. I'm getting a bit emotional, but I was very upset by the whole thing.
Very simple solution. The guidelines have to change on setting trees. The corridors have to widen.
During the meeting, several of the power cuts were blamed on wires brought down in forestry plantations. Councillor Paddy O'Rourke is the Cathaoirleach of Leitrim County Council.
We need to deal with the regulation in relation to forestry, where the plantations of forestries can take place adjacent to important networks of wires. We also need to deal with response in terms of that it's more effective, kicks in earlier and delivers more to the people on the ground. Because we here in this part of the country in the northwest, we were left badly wanting.
The message needs to go up to central government.
Michael McTague from Ballinamore.
I'm also involved in a number of voluntary organisations, the Island Theatre. We were asked 6 days after to become an emergency hub for the town. So for the future, there needs to be a concerted plan put in place. So if we're standing up emergency hubs, to get the support that they need. And that means purchasing generator equipment, Starlinks, satellite broadband, so that these hubs can be stood up immediately after an event like this.
Local TD and Minister of State, Marion Harkin.
There's no silver bullet that will deal with it today, but there are lots of actions that can be taken that mean in 6, 12, 18 months' time, the system is much more resilient and less likely to fail.
Brian Smith from the Save Leitrim Group.
There are so many different agencies that have a hand in the problem and a hand in the solution. From the ESB, Quilche, the Department of Agriculture, Forest Service, the landowners, the forest owners, and the community that's affected here. They all have to be part of the solution. But certainly from the perspective of what we heard tonight, a task force must be set up to bring those bodies together.
RTE Northwest correspondent Shane O'Curraghan's report on Morning Ireland. Independent Senator Lynn Ruan was Oliver Callan's guest this morning. The mother of two, award-winning author and now filmmaker spoke about her new movie, Ready or Not. It's a coming-of-age drama about teenage relationships set in Dublin in 1998, and it's been screened as part of the Dublin International Film Festival. And the host started by asking Lynn where she gets the time to fit it all in.
Well, I think writing is something that I enjoy. Yeah. So it feels more like an additional thing, like something that is a hobby. I think if I was to be a full-time artist and has a different energy than trying to write, where for me, I'm lucky and privileged enough that writing is me having luxury or spare time to do something that I enjoy. And then, yeah.
But it is a career, because the whole idea of the Shannon is to have people out in the real world, because it's not a full-time political job. Isn't that the idea?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I think that's probably historically maybe how some senators treated the Shannon.
Right.
So I wouldn't want to give that false perception. I mean, I definitely work full-time politically. I'm in the chamber 3 times a week, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. But outside of that, I would very much be working in the prisons, in the community sector, definitely all feeding, following, like not like as part of my Shannon role, not extra work.
Yes.
But I would work full-time, I suppose, on the issues that I champion and work on within the Shannon.
It brings you inside and outside the chambers,
yes,
say.
Yes.
So, I mean, quite a hobby to do the writing, because this is it's a career for many people to get a film made. Very difficult to get a film.
It is very difficult, and I think I'm extremely lucky, and I do wonder if, you know, if the things that I write would have got noticed, I suppose, without having the other career that I had. So I do think it has helped that I've had a platform, because then I get to talk and introduce the people, I suppose, in the film industry that have also wanted to work with me because they've read my writing. But not everyone would necessarily get that type of access if they were only writing and trying to break into an industry.
Right. And you have a history here. You have a grow for writing all your life.
I've been writing since I was a child. Yeah.
And there was a short film which was made by the same director.
Yes, Waiting Day. It kind of captures the snapshot in time of women, I suppose, waiting to be paid, waiting under social welfare, mm-hmm. and the struggles that come along with that, but also how resourceful and loving and caring people are towards, I suppose, each other and their loved ones during times of struggle.
And that's how you got to know Claire Frances Byrne, was it? Who's
had met her previously on another thing that she was working on at the time, and she had read some of my writing in the past, and I think she enjoyed how I wrote, and she wanted to maybe work with me and for me to write something specifically for her and her feature debut, which is an honour, I suppose, that somebody with her talent would want to use my writing to also showcase her own talent in such a big way.
That's a fantastic achievement to get amazing. From the short film to the full feature. And in the short, your daughter was in the lead role.
Yes, which is beautiful because I was a young mother and she plays a young mother in it. So it's a little bit of an emotional watch. Mm. You know, the characters are not are fictional, but they're very much based on, you know, realism, like social issues and very believable characters. So to see her play a role that I suppose I can identify with in some ways was an honour. And she's such a special actor. So I think I was just honoured she'd actually work with me and trust me, because she's the real artist in the house.
How so? Explain to us, because she's doing quite a lot, isn't she?
Yeah, she's been acting since she's 12. I mean, she acted first in Frank Berry's I Used to Live Here, which was shot in Tallaght, about cluster suicides, and she's just been doing amazing ever since. And yeah, she's very talented.
And has she gone into Trinity to do?
She did film and English in Trinity. She graduated a couple of years ago. She's 24 now.
So you're both Trinity guys.
Yeah, she actually nominated me. She was one of my nominators, which was a really special moment. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Considering I hadn't finished school, you know, to have for her to go full circle like that was really nice.
Ah, it's quite a family affair then.
Yes.
And there's a little nod to her in the film?
In the...
Ready or Not.
Well, she narrates. She narrates it, yeah. Yes.
She's not on the screen, but she's there.
So
it comes around full circle, the whole connection. The part of the writing, you actually did a course as well.
Yeah, I did a creative writing master's in DCU, and I hadn't expected to like screenwriting so much. It was a module on the course. I hadn't gone specifically to do that mode of writing. But what I enjoyed about it was it very much I could write in my own dialect. So when I write for national media, or if I'm writing for policy, and that, like, it's all different dense types of text.
I see.
And you're having to bring it up to, I suppose, what society is telling you is, like, you know, Harvard English or something. And when I was writing dialogue, I was like, I get to be more authentic, I suppose, to my voice and my dialect. And I really like the flow of screenwriting. So I just kind of dived into it.
It's funny, isn't it? Put your head in the legislative language.
Yes.
Kind of changes your brain.
It does. And it's a bit tiring, you know, because it's a whole different language, you know. So being able to write scripts felt I could tell stories in a way that felt the most real to me, because I didn't have to change pronunciation and I could use the turn of phrase that we would use in working class communities.
Good to be able to have that turn of phrase for dialogue.
Yes.
Writing it for screen in particular. Tell us what the film is about.
Yeah, so it's about growing up in the 90s. It's set in the 90s, but it's not about the 90s. It's in a working class community, but it's not necessarily about class, you know. So I wanted to showcase, first of all the amazing young people across Dublin specifically that wouldn't ordinarily maybe get access to being on front of a camera. Mm-hmm. So a lot of them are on camera for the first time. The backdrop is consent. So it's coming of age in a time where you're at that age where you're kind of, everyone's feeling around in the dark, just kind of bits of pressure on you. You know, you're maybe kissing people for the first time, sex is getting spoke about for the first time, and everyone is probably pretending that they know a little bit more than everyone else, and no one's really discussing the topic. So sexual consent is the backdrop, but it's very much many things. It's also just about friendship and love and growing up and all the confusion that brings.
It's kind of the messy atmosphere of being teenagers.
Yes.
And all been thrown in together with no information really, or understanding what they're doing, what they're
exactly,
where the boundaries are.
Exactly.
And it's very subtly done. This can sometimes sound like, you know, coming of age, teenage relationships can sound a bit grim and depressing, but actually they're having quite a lot of fun in their lives anyway.
They are. And I mean, laughter is a big part of it. Love is a big part of it. And I think sometimes as a young person, unknowingly, you can cross boundaries that nobody has ever told you where those boundaries are, where they lie. You know, young men and women, and young men especially, will I suppose, later on have to answer potentially for boundaries that they crossed, but nobody ever really spoke about positive sexual relationships with young men. So I wanted to subtly tell the story without any real villain, and without any real resolution. You know, people think that there has to be some sort of resolution where if somebody has crossed a line, especially in relation to consent, when nobody actually understood what it was, and then there's some big court case and there's some big, you know,
a handy final judgment.
Yeah, I didn't want that because it doesn't happen and things are messy and sometimes things will happen and then you all still remain in the same space together, in the same community or in the same house. And I just wanted to capture the reality of that in a very subtle way.
So it's kind of like things happen to a group, and maybe individually you know what's happening, but collectively they're naive, aren't they?
Completely naive.
And you don't realise what's happened until you reach the age.
And there's
of
a huge amount of socialisation that has happened, not only to the young people themselves, but also to their parents and the parents before them. So sometimes you can't even identify where your belief system has came from or why you feel like you need to pursue a young girl, so like convince them to be with you. Do you know what I mean? Because you actually don't know where that, you've no way to actually have dialogue about that and understand that. So everybody is just doing what they think is expected of them or what they think their peers are doing without actually having any conversation. And I wanted to set it in that age group because I think sometimes if you set that conversation in even young adulthood, people will kind of say, oh, well, you're old enough now and take responsibility for your actions. And it's kind of like, well, you know, we learn these behaviours.
Yeah.
So I thought maybe to have that conversation at a slightly younger age in the film will allow less judgment and will allow people think about it a little bit more.
Okay, what I want to do is play a scene to give people a flavour of it. It's a short little piece, but it gives us that kind of idea of lines being crossed, even if they don't seem to know what's going on. And also, this is using the language of youth, which is why it's close to reality and the kind of the awkwardness and discomfort and some of the words that they use towards each other.
I'm not a fridgie. Why does all keep saying that?
Even I'm not a fridgie. Even Sarah's not a fridgie.
Everyone has.
Really, though?
Yeah. Listen, Katie's there gonna take us.
Katie's my friend.
I know since we're kids. Friend? Why, are you a little girl or something?
Now, that word, a lot of women and girls, I think, will identify, won't they, with the word frigid?
Yeah, like language has probably morphed and changed over the years. I mean, young people now might say, and I probably sound like a Facebook ma to the young people in the film, but like they might say, are you active or you're not active? You know, all these things.
Is that the words?
Well, that has a kind of connotation for many different things, but having sex is definitely probably included in that. Mm. But yeah, like a frigid was kind of proposed to you like it was a really, really bad thing. So you should not be that. But then if you decided, right, you weren't going to be that, if you were the opposite, you were potentially, you know, called other terms. I don't know whether RT allow the language, but the S word or, you know, stuff like that. So you were kind
being
of...
Being easy would have been a term.
Exactly. So it's a really binary understanding. You're either that or you're that. You know what I mean?
And both of them are shaming.
Exactly. And the last line there where it says, what, you a little girl or something. So even that young bias that it wasn't natural to them to be really trying it on with girls, they would also then come under this other pressure that there was something about their masculinity that was in threat if they didn't also act on this thing of chasing girls. So then bias would make decisions based on this idea of not wanting to be targeted as being soft or, you know, so I wanted to try and capture all those little subtleties and what's happening in people's relationships.
This is the decision you made not to villainise the boys.
Oh, 100%. I think we can't have conversations if we're going to villainise everybody, and I want everyone to be comfortable to have the conversation, you know. And I think the fact that we're doing it in the way with young people and we're setting it in the 90s as well, so far enough away from people that they might feel more okay with talking about it.
Yeah.
And I'm just hoping that not only the discussions, but behind that discussion, there's also the kind of way in which we made the movie. So we wanted to make sure that everyone was authentic to the world. So, you know, we cast out on the streets, with youth workers.
Did you actually cast?
Thankfully with Rue Cody and with Claire Francis Bourne, when we began to work together, I think we found that we shared many, many values. So when I had the kind of idea that I didn't want, you know, to just go straight to big names that would kind of pull interest. So like Fair Play to Screen Ireland and Article 1 and stuff that supported us because we weren't attaching anyone to it, because I wanted them to go out and they wanted to go out onto the streets. So Maureen Hughes and her colleagues.
She's a legendary casting director. Yeah.
So they were on the streets of Cushlan and Talla and Jobstown and Cherry Orchard in the youth clubs, in the youth reaches, in Bluebell. Bluebell was amazing. I mean, they allowed us to use the school there. We were using their community development projects. It really was like me taking my community development hat and just implanting it onto film. making. So it was a really, really amazing, amazing relationship. And hundreds of kids that have never acted before showed up.
Because you found there was the appetite. Audition.
And you're naming it. You're saying this is for you. This is not you trying to break into another world.
Right.
This is your world. And this is for you. And we're looking for authentic working class dialect and authentic working class people. And once you carve out that and say this is what it is, the talent is all there, you know.
And it's just pure authenticity then after that.
Yes.
It sounds like you're frustrated having watched things that maybe don't have that level of...
Yeah, like I know. It's like, I mean, often people tell working class stories, but they've never lived in the working class world. So I find that hard because I think we should be able to tell our own histories. And I think where our communities are full of talent and writers and filmmakers and photographers and everything. I mean, it's no different to other communities. What's different is the access and the who you know. And for me, I wanted to challenge that. I wanted people to see that the talent is there if you go looking for it, and that we can tell our own stories, and we've plenty of stories to tell. And, you know, I can even see if there is a working class kind of character within something, you can see how they might phrase a sentence. And I'd be sitting at home going, nah, like, we wouldn't say that, or that's not how we'd say that word. Or so it there's loads of telltale things in it. But I do remember Frank Berry coming into And when he cast Jordan in I Used to Live Here, he spent...
That's your daughter, Jordan,
yes,
who we forgot to mention
He spent a while, integrating himself into Kilnardine Community Centre, where lots of suicides had happened all around that. And he integrated himself there before he cast there. So it is possible. And that's what we wanted for this film too, was to showcase that there's a huge level of diversity and talent in this country if you actually create the space.
And Michael Inside is another one.
And Michael Inside, which is from Frank Berry as well. Yeah.
It's a prison drama, which is very, very good. So that kind of frustration. Do you watch a lot of film and TV yourself? Do you?
I do.
Time?
I'm not great. I read a lot. I mean, yeah. I do watch film, but I'm not as good at, you know, I wouldn't be as good at analysing films. I know what I like and I know what I don't like. You know, it's more of a feeling I have towards something than an analysis of it.
Okay.
But I read a lot. I mean, I read a lot of philosophy, and I read a little bit of fiction, but I read a lot of philosophy. So I think a lot
that
of
sounds
my,
heavy.
Well, I majored in philosophy in college.
Easy for you?
Yes. Yeah, so well, not easy, but I read a lot of philosophy, and I just think that philosophy allows you to think well. And I think if you can think deeply into ideas, you can then take those ideas onto screen in a different way. Like I think philosophy allows me to have a wide range and I suppose collection of ideas about the world, and I think it helps actually with the screenwriting.
Are there any philosophy, any accessible recommendations?
Well, yeah, at the minute I'm reading, and I'm going to probably butcher his name in French, Edouard Louis, and the history of violence, and he writes about working class experiences, and he's a young guy, he's a French guy, he'd probably say he's a sociologist, I would definitely say a philosopher. And I read a lot of black...
He's a young guy, isn't he?
He is a young guy,
he's a young guy from I grew up in terrible poverty.
Yes, yes.
And a hugely celebrated author in France. Now.
Yeah, he's really, really good. And then I read a lot of American, South American, kind of the rise of the political movements over there. And
really?
Yeah, and lots of great writers. I mean, I read all of Maya Angelou's books last year, and I'd read a lot of Angela Davis and then older philosophers, like, you know, but like I love all the old Socratic dialogues and stuff. So, yeah.
Before we lose you. I should say, by the way, when you're talking about, you know, casting working class people in a working class drama, it's not about blocking the pitch from anyone else doing it. It's about opening it up, isn't it?
Oh, it's about opening
Sometimes
it up.
Sometimes it's misconstrued.
Oh, 100%. I think actors obviously can play whatever. That's not an argument that I'm like wanting to have. I'm just wanting to show that the field is much, much bigger.
Senator and now filmmaker Lynn Ruan chatting to Oliver Callan today. And that's all we have time for on this edition of Playback Daily. So from me, Louise Herity, thanks for listening and take care.